Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots podcast. I'm Caelan Kerwin and Gary Spain joins me this week as part of a three-episode epic into the journey of Limerick football. Today we'll be starting from 1891 through to Limerick's first League of Ireland title in 1960, so stick with us for that. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football, and why not share your own story about it as well while you're at it. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you get notified straight away when a new podcast drops. Now, the story of Limerick football is a long one that starts way back in 1891. And I suppose, Gary, the beginning of that story comes with being a garrison town back then.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, the first evidence I can find of senior football is an army team. And I mean, you have to say as well, the Markets Field has probably always been central to Limerick football. So the earliest senior football game I can find was on the 7th of November, 1891, when the 2nd Battalion of the Black Watch, the obviously British Army, as the whole island, it was part of the UK at the time. So the Black Watch was stationed in Limerick. They're a Scottish army unit. They were Scottish soldiers. And they entered the Irish Cup. They were actually drawn back in October in the first round against a team called Donaghcloney. And I've actually gone and found Donaghcloney. It's a small little village. It's not far off the Belfast Dublin Road, but they decided the journey to Limerick was too much, so they withdrew from the competition. So on the 7th of November, the Black Watch were drawn against Linfield Rangers, who I understand to be a totally separate club to the obviously huge club now that's there in as Linfield, who were still there at this stage. I mean, we can go on and talk about them. They were founded a few years earlier. So Black Watch in the Markets Field on the 7th of November, 1891, defeated Linfield Rangers 5-2, went on to beat the Lancashire Fusiliers 8-2 in the next round, beat St. Columb's Court, went to Belfast to play in an Irish Cup semi-final, and they beat St. Columb's Court from Derry 4-1. And unfortunately, it all went wrong in the final of the Irish, in the final of the 1892 Irish Cup, where Linfield defeated the Black Watch by 7-0.
Is it fair to say that it's a baptism of fire for Limerick football from the start? I suppose they kind of, this team comes along and all of a sudden they're already in kind of cup finals and looking like they might be successful.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the one thing to say is the descriptions of the games talk about big crowds at the Markets Field. So obviously they attracted quite a lot of local interest. An interesting point as well, which obviously didn't come to fruition, was in contemporary newspaper reports, the journalist just writing under the pseudonym Old Guard actually predicted that Limerick would have a team in the Irish League within a season or two. No, that never came to fruition.
The amount of people turning up to watch the games then, is that probably out of probably curiosity a little bit as well? Because football's relatively new-ish in terms of being a sport. So is this a kind of like people kind of wondering, what is this football? Or is it firmly established and people are genuinely there to see and support the team that's there?
I think it's hard to tell. I suppose I think a lot of it might be out of curiosity, but I think we're only guessing really based on newspaper reports, didn't go into huge detail. But I mean, there wouldn't have been huge amounts available there as part of entertainment. I mean, obviously the Markets Field was home to GAA at the time. It was home to rugby. It was the sporting venue in Limerick at the time. Obviously the GAA and rugby went on to get their own homes. I would imagine a lot of it was out of curiosity. It was something to do, something interesting to see. And I suppose teams coming all the way down from Belfast would have been a bit exotic as well in 1891. Yeah. They would have travelled quite a long way.
Things probably people never heard before, which was exotic in Belfast in the same sentence. Yeah. But I jest. Don't at me, Belfast people. So that's the late 1800s, but is it not until the early 1930s where they actually get like an official Limerick team? And I suppose in the build up to that, what's happening in those kind of those intervening years to the early 1930s?
So, I mean, junior football did take off after that. I mean, there's records of clubs like Prospect. They were actually playing the Black Watch as well. I think a different battalion of the Black Watch were in Limerick in the early part of the 20th century. I can't find any records of them playing anything in senior football, entering the Irish Cup or anything like that. So you actually have to go from a senior football perspective, fast forward to 1934. Now, at this stage, the FAI had broken away from the IFA, as we've often talked about, in 1921. The Free State League had been established. The FAI Cup had been established. You had clubs, well, Athlone had come and gone, but the likes of Cork had already gone through a few clubs at this stage, Fortson's being the initial ones. Dundalk had a team in the league. Sligo Rovers had joined the league, and Waterford had joined the league. So the football had spread out from Dublin, but it hadn't come to Limerick yet. And in 1934 are the first record of, let's say, the beginnings of what became Limerick FC. So Waterford sent a Munster senior league side to play Limerick 11 in Roxborough Road. Now, it was the LDMC, which would have been the local junior committee for people outside of Limerick who would know. So they fielded the 11. So it was the best of the Limerick junior side. Now, they were beaten 4-0, but there was a couple of more games organised. Bray Unknowns, who were, well, a forerunner, I suppose, of Bray Wanderers, but they left the league in the mid-1940s. They came down and played a Leinster 11 in the Markets Field as an exhibition game, again organised by the LDMC. But what actually happened on that occasion was a few local players played, and four of them actually, including Brian McSweeney, Sam Greenwood, and a very famous name in Limerick football was Willie Keane, or William Blarney Keane, who... Well, he was a legend in the game as a referee, as a manager, as a player, and one of the great names in Limerick football.
Wow. And so the first kind of semblance of a Limerick team is actually made up of junior team players. Am I right in saying that? That's the kind of, it's not an official, we'll say, Limerick club, but it is a Limerick 11 representative.
Yes, yes. So I think that is important to say. A club had not been formed at this stage. There were a couple of more exhibition matches as well. I should point out, actually, that so this was Bray Unknowns against the Leinster 11, but the Leinster 11 wore the colours of a team called Corinthians, who were playing out of Edward Street at the time. So there was elements there to kind of attract the Limerick public, etc., or to feel more involved, that the four local players on the pitch, one of them was wearing local colours. But it was then that there was a push on at the time to establish the club. Mr. Simmons, A.W. Simmons, was just being that bit cautious and saying the finances needed to be right, etc. And it was another 3 years. It was in early 1937 before the real impetus and the club itself was actually being formed. So there was another exhibition game, Shelburne, and they actually played for the Limerick Challenge Cup, Shelburne and Bohemians. I wonder what happened to that trophy, where it is now. Shelburne defeated Bowes on corners. But after that, there was a round table meeting in Cruz's Hotel, and the officials of the League of Ireland were present, including Mr. Brazel of Drumcondra, J.J. Brennan, the Honorary Secretary, P.J. Casey, the legendary Dundalk official, father of Des Casey, another legendary Dundalk official, and E.J. Ted Dowling of Dolphin, another legendary FAI official. He became Secretary of the League right into the 50s. So there was a lot of the big hitters in Irish football were in Limerick that day on a round table, and there was Limerick officials were there, some of them representing a potential new club and some of them actually representing the Markets Field as it was. So the ground was already being tied into the club. And it's that meeting that set up Limerick FC and took the decision to apply for a place in the League of Ireland for the season that was 37-38.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Like, it's interesting as well that almost from the very beginning of, I suppose, what you'd call an official Limerick FC team or Limerick team, that the Markets Field is tied into to them almost immediately, because when you think of Limerick football, the Markets Field is absolutely synonymous. It runs almost the entire length of Limerick football in the city, doesn't it?
It does, and it is the spiritual home of Limerick football. And I appreciate there was we were absent from it from, well, quite a long time, from 1984 to 2015. But it's always kind of been the spiritual home. And obviously that was crucial for this part of it as well, and for the setting up of the club.
Yeah, so 1937, Limerick FC is elected to the league. They replace Dolphin as well. So where to from here? The team is there. They're official now. So what happens from 1937 onwards?
So I suppose they join the league and start off with a Dublin City Cup tie, and it couldn't get any tougher, away to Shamrock Rovers. And not only that, the goalkeeper O'Brien was injured, so Gormley had to play in goal instead. It looked like it was going to be a tough day, and believe it or not, Limerick went to Dublin, and with a goal from Johnny Curran, pulled off a sensational 1-0 win, which certainly sent shockwaves among the League of Ireland. Billy Douglas was the hero in goal.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible, because, you know, it's a brand new club, and even at that point in League of Ireland history, I'd still imagine Shamrock Rovers are, you know, still one of the teams to beat, and still kind of a big name in Irish football. They've been around quite a long time. So that's a hell of a scalp to get on your first foray into League of Ireland football.
Oh, I mean, they were already with the biggest name. I mean, they'd already won a number of leagues, number of cups. I think they went on to win the league that season as well. So I should say Gormley was the hero in goal. Billy Douglas took over from him for future games. Mm. But it was a sensational result and a huge shock. And it did give a great boost, obviously, to football, that you'd go and beat Shamrock Rovers in your first official match.
So their first official season is 37. It's a great start, but does it last? Do we see this team have a good season in 37? Does it kind of go out through to the 1940s? We see them competing, or is it a good start but ultimately back down to earth?
No, I think it's ultimately back down to earth. There was a 4-1 home win over Waterford in the Shield, but Limerick didn't have that auspicious a season. I mean, Shamrock Rovers came down and hammered Limerick in the Markets Field. Limerick finished the season in 10th place. So they did better, a little bit better in the Cup. They beat Bowes in Dalymount Park before losing to St. James's Gate, who went on to win the Cup. And the draw had already been made against a non-league distillery, so there was even hope of a cup final. But what I should say is that there was a trophy in the first season in the guise of the Munster Cup, which was a fantastic finish to the season. So they played Cork FC, as it was then, in the Munster Senior Cup final in the Mardyke, and it finished in a draw. And the replay was set for the Markets Field, and Limerick beat them 2-0 to win a first trophy. So Jimmy McCann became the first captain to lift a trophy for Limerick. But the man of the match that day was an 18-year-old by the name of Bud Ahern, who, although he was never capped at Limerick, he is probably arguably the best footballer ever to come out of Limerick. He went on to play for Belfast Celtic, play for Luton Town, was capped for the Republic of Ireland, for Northern Ireland, played in many. He was on the pitch in Goodison in 49. One of the greats of Limerick football. And he was the star of that Munster Cup win.
Yeah, absolutely phenomenal player. And I think it's fair to say that, number one, he played with a fantastic Belfast Celtic team as well at the time, but also the teams that he did play with and play for over in England, they still remember him as part of their club football history as well. So I think that's an important thing to point out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he was a key part of Luton Town in particular. I mean, he got 16 caps for the Republic of Ireland. And I mean, I think that needs to be put in perspective, because 16 caps in those days, you would have a number of years to accumulate that. And he also got 4 caps for Northern Ireland, played in a couple of victory internationals as well. And obviously, he had to stop in 1950 when players were no longer allowed to represent both associations.
Yeah, I think now you might be looking at 6 or 7 international games in a year or something like that, whereas back then it was probably about 2, 3?
Yeah, 2 or 3. I mean, some year there was actually a couple of years we played only 1 or whatever. I mean, I have to look back, but there were very few. I mean, we played 10, probably about 10 a year, I'd say, on average at the moment, maybe even 1 or 2 more.
Yeah, so. A fantastic testament to his ability, and a trophy as well, which was a pretty impressive in your first season with the Munster Cup. Was the Munster Cup back then, was it a prestigious thing to win? Because I know now it's not taken perhaps as seriously as modern football probably should take it.
Well, I think the best way to describe how prestigious it was there were, I mean, special trains laid on from Limerick to Cork for the first game in the Mardyke, and hundreds of people left Limerick. And I mean, to travel from Limerick to Cork in those days was quite a big deal. And there was a huge crowd in the Mardyke. There was an equally huge crowd in the Markets Field. There was a big Cork support came up for the replay. So it certainly mattered, and it was a big thing. And there were great celebrations. And obviously, I suppose now it's seen more as a pre-season competition, but it would have mattered a lot more in those days.
Yeah. Going then into the rest of the 1940s as well, and I suppose there's some cup semi-finals in there as well, and some fantastic names that crop out from Limerick in the 1940s.
Yeah, so I mean, there were a couple of lean years after that. The club finished rock bottom, and things started to get a little bit better as we came into the 1940s. A couple of famous names came 40-41 season. Tim Togsey-Kinnean, hugely talented, was capped for Ireland a decade later. He made his debut. And Joe McAleer came, who was a Scotsman who came as manager, made a huge contribution to the club, and sadly passed away as a young man. So things maybe improved slightly, finished 9th in the league, beaten by Waterford in the cup. But I mean, that was actually a very talented Waterford side, and probably going to mention somebody by the name of 4 goals Tommy Byrne. Tommy had actually played in the Markets Field for Cork FC in one of the exhibitions in 1937. Oh. But he signed for Limerick in the 40-41 season. And he became Limerick's first ever representative player when he played for the League of Ireland against the Northern Regional League in St. Patrick's Day in 1942, and became the first Limerick player to score 20 goals in a season in 41-42. And he had a remarkable record, because he was known as 4 goals Tommy Byrne, because in 3 successive games, he scored 4 goals. And he was an incredible striker.
It has to be said, am I right in saying against some decent teams in there as well? Because you have Rovers, Bowes and Bray in there. And
Bray Unknowns, exactly, yeah.
So, I mean, that it's pretty impressive to do against them. But to do it again, you know, to do 4 goals in 3 successive games is pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there were signs then of things improving. Limerick got to the semi-finals of the Cup in 1943, and it took 3 games before they were beaten by Drumcondra. You have the usual hard luck stories around theirs as well. There was a nil-all draw, but there was also a thrilling 3-all draw. And one of the goal scorers was Davy Walsh, who went another famous striker who went on to play for Ireland as well. Drums went on to win the Cup. They beat Cork United a week after beating Limerick. One of the things that probably worth a mention from 1943 as well is that And this is one I cannot prove. Well, I can prove what actually happened, but the actual story. So Limerick entered the league. It was decided in 1937. The committee that formed Limerick FC decided by one vote to play in cardinal red and white stripes. And the other option was the black and amber of Young Munster Rugby Club. So I think that might have lost a lot of loyalty around Limerick rugby fans. But but anyway, so the red and white would have been neutral. But the story that was told when I was a young boy on the popular side in the Marketsfield is that Limerick bought the blue Waterford jerseys. And Waterford had left the league in 1941. The Limerick jerseys had got incredibly ragged by 1943. And if you look at the photograph of the team that played in the FAI Cup semi-final, I mean, there's rips, collars torn, and there was no swapping jerseys in a jersey per game or anything in those days.
Names on the shirts.
So the legend is that Limerick bought the blue Waterford jerseys, and from 1943 on, blue, more or less since then, has become the colour of Limerick football. The only reference I can find is a thing in the Limerick Leader in the summer of 43, talking about Kevin Holman. And he didn't actually sign, as it turned out. But there was talk of him who had played for a Limerick man who had played for Waterford, that he might like to be back in his blue Waterford jersey at the Markets Field for Limerick. So I think I might be stretching it, but having said that, I mean, when I was hearing these stories in the likes of 71, 72, 73, it was only 30 years after the event. Mm. And obviously the men telling those stories would have been going since the start. So I certainly believe it, even if I can never prove it.
So before 1943, it's red and white stripes. Am I getting that right? So red and white stripes. So then they basically the shirts have fallen apart. So they kind of go, we need new shirts. So the color change comes about from basically no kind of compelling kind of, we should all be in blue for this reason. You know, kind of associated with the local area or something like that. It's kind of sounds like it's just a need for new jerseys, so we're going to go blue.
Well, the Waterford had left the league in 1941, which we talked about in a previous podcast. Mm. So there was no club in Waterford at the time. So
they weren't doing anything with
them. They had no need. Well, they weren't doing anything with the blue jerseys, so it's certainly plausible that Limerick would have bought them. But I can't find any definitive mention of that in the newspapers to confirm that at the time.
Yeah, interesting. And I think it is an important thing, because it's the definitive colour of Limerick football then, going right up to now, right up to the modern day, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
I know there was changes in between somewhere, but it's always kind of come back to blue.
It has. I mean, for me, and I think for nearly anybody else, blue is the colour of Limerick football. And I appreciate Treaty United started out in red and white stripes for various reasons, which is certainly the next best thing, obviously being the original colours from 1937. But the reality is there's nobody alive that can remember Limerick playing in red and white stripes before 1943. So I think blue has become the de facto colours of Limerick football.
Hmm. And so we go into the 1950s, and the first major trophy of Limerick's history.
Yeah, I should mention the second place finish in the league. The mid-40s, things got a lot better. Finished second twice, actually, in the mid-40s. Got to a cup semi-final in 1947. So it was probably a little bit unfortunate not to win something or come closer to winning something. But then things again took a little bit of a downturn, 47-8, 48-9. Maybe mention Johnny Gavin briefly, one season in Limerick. Top scorer, sold to Norwich City. He was capped for Ireland as well, obviously, and remains Norwich City's all-time top scorer. But as you went on up to 1953, Limerick was 16 years in the league at this stage and hadn't won a national trophy. And it it was the change with the League of Ireland Shield. And I think it's important to state, I mean, the League of Ireland Shield is obviously gone, but it was a hugely important trophy at the time. So it was considered the third trophy after the league in the FAI Cup. It was run on a league basis, but it was one round at the start of the season. So you played everybody once, either home or away. And then on alternate years, you'd be at home, let's say, to Rovers in the Shield, and the following year you'd be away to them. It typically worked out like that. Now, I mentioned William Blarney Keane, who had played in that game way back in 1934. He refereed the 1946 FAI Cup final, for example. Huge Dublin derby, Drums and Rovers. So Blarney was manager at this stage in 1953. And one of the things he did was he put the players through a very tough pre-season fitness campaign for the summer of 1953. Well, it paid dividends because the start of the season, Limerick went on a run in the Shield. It all came down to the... Well, I'll talk about actually a pivotal day in the destination of the Shield, first of all, because Limerick were chasing Drumcondra and Drumcondra and Shelburne were in the mix. So on Sunday, the October 18th, Drumcondra were beaten 3-0 by Waterford in Kilcone Park, and Limerick went up to Dalymount Park and defeated Shelburne 3-2 with two goals from Beaver Cronin, who didn't play that long for Limerick, but he had a huge impact. And that win and Drum's defeat put Limerick top of the Shield by a point from both Drumcondra and Shamrock Rovers. So Limerick needed two wins at that point to win the Shield. It was fully in their own hands. And the first one was in the Markets Field against Waterford, who I suppose were traditional rivals at the time. And there was a massive crowd in the Markets Field, and Limerick battled to a 2-1 win, but it was a nervy win. And Rovers and Drums both won. So they were all a point behind. And so it came to the last day. So Sunday, the 1st of November, 1953, Limerick were away to Dundalk and they needed a win to win the Shield. So Shamrock Rovers had already beaten Bowes on the Saturday, so nothing but a win would do. Limerick went to Dundalk. It was special trains, buses, a massive crowd, one of the biggest exoduses ever out of Limerick. My father would have been 14 at the time. It was the first time he ever left Limerick, and he went on his own to Dundalk from Limerick for this game. But it was one not to be missed.
That's such a great story, though, for your dad. I mean, like, 14 years old, just going, you know what? I'm going to this.
Well, it started off incredibly badly, and it looked like Dundalk were going to do a big favour to Shamrock Rovers and Drums as they led 2-0 with only 25 minutes to go. And it wasn't looking good. So Blarney Keane, he switched the forwards. He moved Georgie Lynham, who was an inside forward, out to the wing and brought Beaver Cronin into inside right. And Sean Cusick, again, another player who was capped for Ireland at Limerick, one of the greats of Limerick football, he was fouled in the box and took the penalty himself to make it 2-1. But Limerick still had to win the game. The cheering had hardly subsided from the penalty when Peter Bradley set up Georgie Lynham. And Georgie went away in the wing. It proved what a master stroke it was. And his shot was deflected in off Matty Clark. And suddenly it was 2-2. And within another couple of minutes, Beaver Cronin, the man who'd been switched from the wing to inside forward, he was set up by Georgie Lynham, and he made it 3-2. So 3 goals in 4 minutes. Limerick held on to win 3-2. And that caused massive celebrations among the huge, huge travelling support.
Fantastic. If you're going to win a cup, I tell you what, that's no better way to win it, coming from behind like that. And I would imagine that...
I should mention as well the celebrations, because obviously there were hundreds of Limerick people up in Dundalk, but thousands were waiting for the train to come back late that night when it pulled into Colbert Station. St Mary's Fife and Drum Band were there, and Beaver Cronin was carried shoulder high from the train.
Wow.
And there were massive celebrations in the city for winning the Shield.
Absolutely fantastic. A first major trophy for Limerick football, then it is. So what happens after this then from 1953 as we move into the middle of the 50s then?
I mean, money was probably was tight in Limerick football. There were a couple of years, a couple of good cup runs, got to the semi-final in 1957. We're a little bit unlucky not to beat Rovers the first day, but you never get a second chance against Rovers, and Rovers won the replay. At the end of the 50s, things did seem to start looking up a bit, because Limerick won the Dublin City Cup in 58-59 season, which was a second national trophy, and it was a big surprise. They went to Dublin and beat the mighty Drumcondra 4-3 in the final, and that might sent some shockwaves.
Can I ask, how does a Limerick team end up in the Dublin City Cup? Was it a general invitational thing, or was it how does that work?
Well, that was a pre-season competition. Oh, it was normally played as a knockout, or sometimes a few years briefly on a league basis. But it was played by all teams, so it wasn't just for the Dublin clubs. So all teams in the league competed for it. It was done away with in the 70s, when kind of the Shield, the Dublin City Cup, they were all amalgamated into the new League Cup, which of course is gone now as well. Mm. So it was a pre-season. I mean, it wouldn't have been as prestigious as the Shield, but certainly to beat some Condra 4-3 in Dublin meant quite a bit, you know.
Yeah, and we should mention as well, Drumcondra were, at the time, they no longer exist, of course, but they were a top club in the area, and were for a while a phenomenal team.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, they were the huge club on the north side of Dublin, and I mean, it needs to be remembered, Bohemians were an amateur club for well, for much of the 50 years, the first 50 years in the League of Ireland. Appreciate that they had been very successful for some of that, but for much of the 40s, 50s, 60s, Bohs were down near the bottom of the league, and it was the likes of Drums and Rovers who were competing for honours, and Shells, of course, were also there as well.
So two major trophies then under the belt for Limerick. Where does it go then from the late 50s into the 60s then?
Well, I suppose having won the Dublin City Cup, they were a little bit optimistic for 59-60 season, and it started very well. Some very impressive wins, beating Waterford, Shelburne 4-2, putting 8 past Bohemians, and Limerick tried to keep pace with a very impressive St. Pat's team in the Shield, but a couple of defeats by Drums and Transport proved damaging, and Pats went on to take the Shield. Maybe try to mention a game against Dundalk in October 1959, when Stanley Matthews was present to meet both teams. But ultimately, Pats went on to take the Shield, with Limerick finishing as runners-up. But that was seen as quite a successful start to the season. And there was a bit of hope then going into the league that Limerick could maybe compete for league honours, but it didn't start off very well. A 3-2 defeat by Shelburne away on opening day. Couple of famous names with the goals. Georgie Lynham, who'd been the star of the Shield win, still banging the goals in. And Donny Wallace, one of the, well, I would have to say a legend of Cork football, because he played for Cork Hibs for so many years and contributed so much. What a wonderful player. But he was also a brilliant player for Limerick, and very fondly remembered. So it was a bit of a strange start to the season. Limerick were decent at home, beat the champion Shamrock Rovers 1-0 at the Markets Field, but lost the first three away games. So it was three home wins, three away defeats, and didn't seem to be in the title hunt at all. Gradually, Limerick started to move back up the table. Sligo and Transport were both struggling near the bottom of the league. They were both beaten, and Limerick was starting to impress. And they crushed Bohs 6-1 in Dalymount Park in January 1960. Oof. And that kind of, well, it sent out a bit of a message that maybe Limerick were going to be in contention. And at this stage, Limerick had still won every single home game. So it was very much Fortress Marketsfield, St. Pat's, who defeated, who had won the Shield, were beaten 2-0 at the Marketsfield, and they hadn't been able to take their Shield form into the league, and they were down in mid-table. So then Shelburne were in town, who had beaten Limerick on the opening day, and Limerick made it 6 wins in a row by beating Shelburne 3-1. Wow. And which left Limerick top of the league. But next game, champion Shamrock Rovers away in Milltown, and the bubble got burst after 6 wins in a row and a 2-1 defeat. But bounced back, beat Waterford 5-0, which was quite impressive. Beat Longford Town in the cup. Unfortunately, went out at home to Waterford in the cup. Again, a few hard-fought home wins, big win over Cork Hibs. Went down to Cork then to face Cork Celtic and beaten 4-0. And it's kind of, look, is it going to happen? So with 5 games to go, Limerick were level with Shelburne at the top of the table. And Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers were a point behind. And both Cork clubs were another point behind. So there were 6 clubs within 2 points at the top of the table. So it was anyone's title at this stage.
Sorry, so going into the... what, the second last or the last week? There's
no with five games to go.
Oh, 5 games to go. Sorry, 5 games
to go. There was 2 points between 5 teams. So Limerick went to Sligo 1-4-1, and Waterford had held Shelburne to a draw. So suddenly, with 4 games to go, Limerick were a point clear. And again, Limerick went to Dublin, beat Transport, beat Bohemians, and so Dundalk were coming to the Marketsfield as title contenders for Limerick's last home game of the season, with an away trip to Dublin to come. The Marketsfield was absolutely mobbed, 10th of April 1960, and Limerick needed a win to stay top. Dundalk needed a win to keep their title hopes alive. Rovers were playing Shelburne and Milltown at the same weekend, but both sides were a point below Limerick. The Marketsfield was packed to the rafters, and again, Dundalk nearly spoiled the party in 53. They led 1-0 at halftime in the Marketsfield as well. But Jerry McCarthy, great centre half, came up from the back, and he showed the forwards how to do it with heading in an equaliser. And late in the game, Limerick were awarded a penalty, and Jerry took it himself and buried it in the net. So a huge 2-1 win for Limerick. And Rovers and Shells drew at Milltown, which left Limerick only needing a draw away to Pats on the last day to clinch the title. And Pats were down in mid-table and out of contention.
Well, I always feel in football is the red flag when you need points and you have to play a team mid-table to have absolutely nothing to lose whatsoever. As well, is that how it turned out?
So Shamrock Rovers, Shelburne were both in contention as well. Rovers had a midweek back match against Cork Hibs, which they lost. So then it was down to Limerick or Shelburne for the title, and Limerick just needed a draw away to Pats. And in those days, you could actually move big games. So Pats moved the game to Dalymount Park because they reckoned there were going to be about 5,000 people up from Limerick for it, and they wanted the money. So the attendance was recorded as 15,000 people paid into Dalymount Park. And if anything was more than 5,000, they reckon most of the crowd was from Limerick. So a little bit of a reshuffle. Fergie Crawford had to withdraw before kickoff, but it all seemed to start so well. Jerry O'Brien set up Dick O'Connor, and Limerick had an early lead, but Pats equalised just before the half hour. Jerry O'Brien set up Jimmy Murphy to give Limerick the lead again on 45 minutes, with only a draw required. The game entered the last 20 minutes. It seemed safe enough, but then Pats equalised 20 minutes to go, and then the nerves came in. So 5 minutes to go, and it could have been one of the most controversial incidents being talked about forever in Limerick football, but in general things, it's probably been forgotten. So 5 minutes to go, the ball appeared to have gone well over the end line, and the linesman appeared to indicate a goal kick. the Limerick player stopped, but the Pats winger still crossed the ball, and it was Ronnie Whelan scored, and the referee awarded the goal. And there was furious protest from Limerick. The fans were going nuts, but the goal stood, and Pats went on to win 3-2. And everyone was livid. Limerick were robbed of the title. Even my dad and others were walking out of the Daily Mount Park, walking back to King's Bridge, thinking the title was gone, and Limerick were cheated. And they had no idea what was going on in Cork, because Cork Celtic had done Limerick a huge favour and had beaten Shelburne 4-3.
Wow.
So it was only walking back to King's Bridge to get the train to Limerick that the fans got the news that Shelburne had lost and that Limerick were champions.
Wow. What a role reversal of emotions. I mean, people must have been absolutely sunk walking out of that game against Pats. And then I presume they heard it on the from the radio or from other people on the way back to the train station. And
yeah,
all of a sudden,
it was word of mouth in those days. I mean, my father used to recount when Limerick were away, the only way to get the result was at about 5 o'clock, 5:30 on a Sunday. You go up to the offices of the Limerick Leader, and somebody in the Leader would get a phone call and get the result down from Dublin or Sligo or Dundalk. And they'd put up on a card in the window, let's say Shamrock Rovers 0, Limerick 2. And you'd have hundreds of men, and it would be mainly men in those days, standing outside looking at the window and either cheering or being devastated.
Brilliant.
And then they'd walk home. So that's how you got your football results in the 50s and 60s. Well, I mean, maybe in the 60s, the radio was becoming a little bit more prevalent, etc.
But it's such a great thing that, you know, in order to get the results, you all had to congregate together and kind of be together. And I suppose, and share that moment, whether it was good or bad, of finding out the results. I think that's really great. But
yeah.
But that being said, Cork Celtic then beat Shell, so you're national champions now, you're League of Ireland champions, and that must have been an extraordinary day in Limerick.
Oh, it was huge. I mean, be 23 years in the league and to be national champions for the first time, so it was absolutely massive. And again, that sparked off great celebrations as well.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. The celebrations probably went long into the night as well. And what's, do we know, was there cross-community support for football in the city? Was football an all-encompassing thing? Or was it, you know, you had your GA people and your rugby people and you had football? Or was it just, you had your factions, or was it an all-encompassing thing?
No, I mean, I suppose Limerick had always been a rugby city. Mm. So, but if Limerick were successful, there was certainly quite a lot of crossover. The rugby fans would go and support the football team, particularly if they're successful. The GAA at that stage was mainly out in the county. And of course, the ban was still in place. So GAA people were not allowed to play or attend football or rugby in those days. So I suppose, even in the 1960s, football and rugby were very much played in the towns and cities. And in a lot of rural areas, you wouldn't have had a football club until well into the 1960s, into the 1970s, when the ban was removed.
Hmm. So is it fair to say that at the time Limerick become national champions, it's very much a city-based sport and a city-based support?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that back in those days, it was very much a city team that, let's say, as you know, hurling, if you just go a few miles outside the city, you have all the hurling strongholds of Patrick's Well, South Liberties, Ballybrown. I'm going to forget a couple and apologies. And I know hurling has become very strong in Limerick City in recent years since I've moved to Dublin, but back even when I was growing up, hurling, the county championship was always won by, well, I'll say Patrick's Well, and someone's going to prove me. Sorry, and
you're poking a bear there.
I am, and I'm on very, very sticky ground because my knowledge of Limerick hurling would be very weak. But to me, it would typically have been the county clubs, the likes of the Patrick's Wells, the South Liberties, the Han, the Kilmallock, Ballybrown, and I'm sure there's one or two more, that they would have been the ones that would have been winning Doon, I think, winning county titles, all the big names. In Limerick hurling would typically have come from these clubs, and I appreciate there's bitter rivalry between them as well, so let's just leave it at that. But hurling would be very, very strong around the rings around the city, and of course you really have to go down to the Kerry border to find any Gaelic football in Limerick.
Well, that's it for this episode. You can hear part two in a couple of days, with part three coming a couple of days after that as well. So you won't have to wait long to hear the rest of the Limerick footballing story. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football, and why not share your own stories about it while you're at it. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you get notified straight away when a new episode drops. And remember, support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League teams. It's our heritage, it's our game. Bye for now.